This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 35. And I'm delighted to be joined today by John Goodall, CEO and co-founder of Landbay, a member of the P2P FA, leading UK P2P / marketplace lending platforms. Landbay connects retail and institutional lenders with loan assets in the UK residential buy-to-let mortgage. They have a well-secured belt and braces in approach, as not only do they have security in terms of the mortgage over the asset, but also they have a provision fund. Furthermore, these assets are all delivering a rental income stream from tenants. Stress testing is a very important topic across finance, though is all too often one that's poorly understood. Why? Well, one of the unique things about finance is that it almost always relates to the future, the unknown future. If you buy a pint of beer, you could drink it now. You can eat a cheese sandwich now, so you know what it's like. But invest money and, well, as Yoda put it, always in motion the future is. Stress testing basically amounts to what would happen if the shit hits the fan. Would investors lose 1%, 10% or 100%? In crowdfunding early stage equity, this is an easy calculation. The answer is obviously 100%, you'd lose the lot. But what about in P2P debt in a well-diversified portfolio? Well, as we will find out, it's not a trivial question. In essence, it's not trivial, as one has to decide how much shit of what type hits what fan. As I never cease to try and explain to the non-FS crowd who have leapt on the fintech bandwagon, in FS, the devil is always in the detail. Not only that, but in an uncertain world, even so-called experts can't be trusted. A couple of years ago, the ECB, the European Central Bank, had European banks stress test their portfolios. A few months later, many banks had already experienced losses beyond these worst-case expectations. So perhaps that was more of a press test than a stress test. And once again, it's yet more FS BS. But back to the present. John's an ideal person to talk to about this subject, as Landbay has just spent time and money getting their portfolio independently stress tested. So he's well placed to talk to the challenges, value, and limitations of the methodology, as well as, I hope, reveal some of their results. Plenty to talk about, so let's go on with the show. Hi, John. Thanks for joining me today.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
And you arrived very hot foot from your son's first day at school, which is an interesting rite of passage.
Absolutely. He's actually 8, so he's just moved schools.
So he's a slow starter, isn't he?
Yeah, no, he's not a slow starter. He's done, I mean, get this right, he's in year 4, which actually means you've already done 4 years of school. So, bizarrely, it's his 5th year of school. Oddities of the UK system. And he's just started a new school, which, as it happens, is about 300 metres from where we're sitting now. So it's quite convenient for the morning commute.
That's very convenient. Well, hopefully, as he's 8 years old, he won't be crying on his first day at his school. My girls are in the sixth form. One's in lower six and the other's in upper six in old money. I don't know what it is in all these year things. I can never remember it these days. And their challenges are slightly different. The younger one always gets told off for having dresses that are too short. A friend of mine who is 50-something said the same problem happened in Lithuania 40-odd years ago. The teachers would have a go at girls for short skirts. And my older one seems to spend most of her time seeing what tops she can get away with, stretching the boundaries.
I think with young boys, it's more about smuggling match attacks cards and football books, etc., and stickers into school rather than anything else yet.
Yes, I remember eating pork scratchings and things like that and trying not to get caught out. And then going back to the 70s, there was this awful stuff called space dust, which basically fizzed tremendously in your mouth. Yeah, so the thing to do in maths was to see if you could consume space dust without being noticed. And fintech is kind of a new boy, a new kid on the block, not to stretch the analogy too much, or stretching it too much, who cares. And where do you think sort of fintech is in school terms? If fintech were a little lad going to school, which year or which age group do you think it's in now? Or P2P?
P2P, I mean, well, I suppose, you know, Zopa, I suppose, were the pioneers in the space, and they set up, I think it was 10 years ago, I think they've just had their 10-year birthday party, and so I suppose that would put them at sort of GCSE level, I suppose.
That's a great soundbite.
To be honest, then, I suppose not much else happened for about another 5 years after that, and I think then Funding Circle and Rate Setter were next. So in that sense, that's about 5 years ago, so I suppose that we're somewhere between year 5 and GCSE year. So somewhere in puberty, anyway.
No, that sounds very good. I buy the puberty thing, and I also remember some comment about fifth form know-it-alls. When you're in the fifth form, just before your GCSEs, you think you kind of know it all. And then you go into the A-levels and you find actually there's a bit more that you didn't know. And then you go to university and then you go into the big world. And actually each time it's like a whole new dimension opens up in front of you. And I'm sure this is going to keep happening for fintech and P2P. But I think I'd buy that. I think, yeah, GCSE level for the better ones. And some of the others are probably still having the first day at age of 8, or some of them even at age of 4. So in terms of this constant flow of change, what we call life then, you didn't start off as a CEO of a land bay. How's your career journey been?
I know a fair bit about education and teaching, but I'll come back to that in a minute. But I started life off actually as a headhunter. I used to work for generally investment banks and try and steal their competitors' best people and move them around and promise them more money, et cetera, et cetera. And I then set up a headhunting business in about 2002 with a couple of other individuals and built it up and then sold it in early 2007. So as it happens, just 9 months or so, the other shit hit the fan.
You're Mr. Market Timing then?
Yes, it was quite fortunate in that sense. And again, it's an interesting comparison. I'd been doing it for 10 years and it seemed a natural time to sort of hand the reins to someone else. We were on the verge of international expansion, and so I felt actually to get fresh people in to do that was probably best. And also in terms of bubbles, while I wouldn't have predicted what happened, I could see that salaries in banks and financial services were getting ridiculously high. And I take a view that actually when you look at top exec pay, those people, and this might not make me popular, often deserve those numbers. So the people who are earning £3 or 4 million a year, actually it can be straightforward to justify, can be, not always. What you're looking at is actually when 26-year-olds with 4 years experience are earning £1 million. And that's when I think you start to realise the top of salaries. It's the sort of, it's the same in the Premier League. The very top, the players at Man United and Arsenal, they probably deserve it. It's the players in the sort of bottom half of the league, when they're earning big money, then you know that salaries are slightly hard to justify.
Yes, well, we could get into a long digression on the word deserve there.
Okay.
So, you know, it's really a question of what is a free market and what's going on and all these kind of things. And you could say that football is a free market, but of course it isn't, because, you know, we are in Victoria. We're not a million miles from where Mr. Abramovich hires people at great expense to kick a leather ball around a pitch. And, you know, the flood of money into that has really distorted the marketplace. And going back to the 70s, I supported Aston Villa for my sins in the 1970s. And in those days, footballers were paid so little in the then, quotes, free market, that they had to go and open a pub when they retired because they had no money whatsoever.
Exactly.
So what's right and what's deserving is a big issue. But it's interesting hearing you say that you formed a business in the past, which you grew and you sold, and you knew at which point you wanted to get out of it, because there aren't that many people in the fintech world who have previous experience of growing firms, selling firms, and then also, as I've been talking to one or two people recently, understanding in their own heart which stage of the cycle they like. It's one thing to grow a firm from 1 to 10, from 10 to 100. It's another thing to run a firm of 10,000 people where you're just sitting on a boring board with inches thick committee meetings and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. And I think particularly for large firms, you end up spending your whole time talking to what they now call stakeholders as opposed to sort of running a business.
Yeah, as opposed to doing the business. Absolutely. So you kindly offered to talk to us about stress testing today, stress testing the P2P marketplace lending arena. So I guess just to start with the basics, what do you think stress testing means, or what do your friends, what has stress tested your portfolio, think stress testing means? What is it supposed to mean these days?
Well, stress testing for us and the way we approached it is, in some ways the reason why it's linked to what it is that over the last 4 or 5 years has been a very benign credit environment. At some point, that is going to change. And so what we've tried to do is to sort of look in the crystal ball a little bit and sort of think, well, what might happen when actually the credit environment or the economy turns south, or unemployment starts increasing, or interest rates go up, or house prices fall, in our case, which is relevant. And so really what that looks like, because peer-to-peer lending, whatever type of peer-to-peer lending, should be viewed as a longer-term investment. It's not instant access. And while there are secondary markets that exist, people should go into it with their eyes open and realize they can't necessarily get their money out straight away. And therefore, people have to think of a 3, 4, 5 year horizon in terms of returns. And in 3, 4, 5 years from now, the environment is likely to be very different to what it is now. And so that's what we tried to replicate, really.
So that makes a lot of sense. So basically you're saying that, as far as you can see, and I'm sure this is true, we basically are in fair weather at the moment, and you rather wonder what might happen if we come into foul weather. Or rather, as we're in the UK, we've had fairly foul weather. It was one of the coldest Augusts on record, and it's now pretty chilly September. As I mentioned on the show before, in 1992, I was basically like George Smiley. I sat in a room with all the files from Clonmel Benson, trying to work out how on earth you'd work out what the risk was in all the businesses on a comparable basis across the bank, which was an interesting challenge. And one of the things that occurred to me about markets was that markets generally exhibit what you might call normal behaviour. So most of the time, markets, whether it's property or equity market or whatever, do sort of things normally in a fairly sort of predictable fashion. And then I had this idea that, but actually what also happens is you have these extreme events, and extreme events are very, very common. And importantly, you can't relate the extreme events to the normal events, which is all too sadly you see doing. People say, oh, five standard deviations. Standard deviation is the language of what normally happens. You know, when something really has come out of left field, it's something completely different. So I did then think about the extreme case. And one of the problems with the extreme case, which I think relates to where the European Central Bank were coming from before, is if you take the extreme case, in the extreme case, it's a disaster. And RBS goes bust and Lloyds goes bust and all that kind of thing by definition. And in a way, there's a slight conflict because accounting works on the basis of going concern. I don't think it's generally realised, but all accounting starts by assuming that the company's going to carry on and does it from that basis. So applying my mentality of stress testing, which is what happens in the worst case, to a personal basis, well, in the worst case, you fall over, you break your leg, someone steals your car, your wife's in hospital, your mum drops dead, and the school calls and your kids fall in the swimming pool. And in these cases, you know, it's really tough to carry on. So I think the thing that I'm not so sure about where we've got to at the moment is how stressful the stress test is, yeah, if you like. How much do you push it? Because in the worst case, the shit hits the fan and we're all dead. You know, in the worst case, all these businesses blow up. And the same with banking. And what I get informally in terms of banking is that the regulatory stress test is challenging, but isn't too challenging. Because if you make it too challenging, the answer is, of course, all banks go bust again. Because they're hyper-leveraged.
Absolutely. And there is that doomsday scenario where every single person defaults and the security is worthless or close to worthless.
There's nuclear war. And
exactly, in that situation. We totally take that point. And this is not, despite me using the word crystal ball, this is not really our assumptions about what we think might happen. It is a case of, okay, if we take a scenario that is bad, but not unrealistic, what happens? And what we've then done is, as people often asked, is, you know, and we'll come on to exactly our type of stress test, is the key variables for our sort of business are unemployment, because will people stop demanding rental property and will they stop paying the rent and therefore the landlord's under stress, and house prices and going down. So if there is a default, what you get back. And so the question we were asked as soon as we started speaking to people about the stress test, and we said, well, we're imagining unemployment doubling and house prices fall by 20%. The next question is, well, what happens if unemployment triples? Yeah, or unemployment, yeah, yeah. Or house price fall by 30%? So then actually we did that. So, and again, you can take it to a certain point where, like you say, you get to a doomsday where you get nothing back. But it's good to see, and it's quite surprising what the key variables are and actually how some things affect the stress test more than others. And actually, it is somewhat counterintuitive in terms of how our book performs and what the key drivers for losses are, because, you know, it's not necessarily what people expect.
Yes, I mean, there's a lot in what you say, and I agree with all of it. I mean, one of them, I think, was it Moltke, the Austrian general, that said, plans are useless, but planning is essential. And by going through the exercise, you get much more of an understanding of what's going on. That's the first thing. And then I think the second thing, which is where this whole trend that started in the late 90s for so-called risk measurement, as opposed to risk modelling, went wrong, is that it tended to come out with single number answers. So, oh, the VAR of JP Morgan is $5 billion. Or we stress tested JP Morgan and the stress test is 5 trillion. A number's just a number. And as you say, once you start picking it apart, it's very, very arbitrary. What you're talking about makes me think much more of a surface. So if you imagine a sort of 2D or 3D chart with the various parameters that you're talking about, unemployment or property prices, and then the surface of results. So as it were, you know, I think it's going to fall 13% here and 20% there. Okay, well, in which case, you just look at the chart and that's the number there. And in a way, the stability or the flatness of that surface or the jaggedness of the surface tells you quite a lot as well at a second order effect, which is that, wow, our portfolio is really sensitive to this parameter, but pretty insensitive to that parameter.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think the other thing that you're pointing to, which is really essential, you know, for listeners who may be investing and their P2P says they've done a stress test, is that you really need to have deep understanding of the particular marketplace, because otherwise you get something, oh yes, GNP falls 2%, you know, unemployment goes up 3%, inflation is 5%, what happens in your portfolio? That's just so abstract as to be not meaningful. And in terms of this point, as I mentioned before, you had an external stress test. In terms of this point, a specialist, how did you use specialists? Because I don't think he's always realised that many people do their stress test internally. That's nice, that's good, but there's a big difference between an internal stress test where I've calculated my numbers and an external one where you've come along and calculated my numbers.
Absolutely. I mean, we could spend a couple of hours on Excel and knock up a number and say, house prices do this, this is what will fall. But what we did is we went to a specialist called MIAC. They work in both the UK and the US, and they work for a lot of mortgage lenders, both residential and buy-to-let, a lot of the large, well-known lenders on both sides of the Atlantic. And they do these sorts of things for those players for reasons around securitization, but also actually for some of the banks who have to formally go through this process, and they look at those mortgage books. And so they have huge amounts of data in terms of what has happened to mortgages over the last 15 to 20 years. And the reason we did it with them is actually they know the sort of the assumptions that we need to look at around our credit policy. But what they did with our portfolio is, rather than sort of just putting it through an imaginary model, they actually, within their huge data set, they found mortgages that looked very much like ours. Therefore, the pool of data they had, they got it down to a pool of still a few thousand mortgages, and we have a lot less than that, that basically they created almost a shadow portfolio of mortgages that actually existed and how those performed. And that was the sort of crux of the model in terms of starting it.
So really, you're talking about the fact that in your specific subset of the P2P world, you've got a very data-rich environment.
Exactly.
And this, again, makes a huge difference.
Absolutely. And even though we are a relatively young lender...
Yeah. Mortgages are not relatively young. There's a lot of properties in the UK. There's a lot of buy-to-let. There's a lot of data out there. So it's fairly meaningful compared to, for example, I might imagine, let's say, SME lending. I mean, all SMEs are very different. It's a very heterogeneous sector.
Exactly. And I don't think the lenders pool data in the same way. So obviously, within mortgages, there's the Council of Mortgage Lenders, which a lot of the large lenders are members of, and they in itself, they gather data, and you know, people can get access to it if you're members or associate members. I don't think anything similar exists. I don't think there's a council of SME lenders or a council of consumer lenders, and if there is, I think it's more a trade group as opposed to a data-centric organisation.
Yes, when Christian Faes was on the podcast, I think last November, from LendInvest, he was making a similar point that you know, the mortgage market is so vast, is so deep, is so rich in information that you can know more about it and model it much more than any other sector.
Absolutely.
Which is something going for it. So we've spoken about where the parameters come from. We've spoken about the fact that you've used external specialists who, again, have got their own data and they can do this on a more nuanced basis than you and I knocking up a spreadsheet and getting the answer we wanted in the first place. Set against that, there's going to be data restrictions. As you say, the oldest peer-to-peers have been going 10 years. The youngest one's probably just a few months. Do you have anything to say on how you stress test a portfolio when you've got very limited data?
Yes, I mean, as I said, we were fortunate that we could almost replicate our portfolio. So they looked at detail of both our actual loan book and also our credit policies and our underwriting policies to imagine, A, what our loan book is now, but actually how it might develop over the next year or 2 years and how it builds up. And as I say, what they then looked to do is, through a pool of data they had, they looked at actually how the mortgages, very similar to ours, actually performed throughout the crisis. And they therefore created effectively a shadow portfolio. That sounds a little bit dodgy, but a portfolio that almost replicates in type the sort of mortgages that we lend on.
So in that case, it doesn't really matter whether you've been going 1 year or 10 years, because actually you're looking at today's portfolio and using their data.
They're doing both. That's how they're building the base model, and then they're putting our loans through it as well. But at the point of the stress test, so one, we've had about 40 mortgages. Obviously, that one of the issues when you think about 40 mortgages is if one or two loans go bad quickly, your numbers get quite large. And so you have to sort of extrapolate it out and think, okay, actually, if this was 200 or 500, we can't just times this portfolio by, you know, 20. We have to look at things that actually they fit with the portfolio and the sort of loans that you would see application for and that you would accept.
Yeah, so this comes back to the point that I think it's very interesting to think of a stress test as a surface in parameter space. And of course, one of the parameters, if I'm an investor, is how many assets I'm exposed to.
Absolutely.
If I'm exposed to one asset, then obviously my stress test is I could lose the lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
In the worst case, if I'm exposed to 100, then that's another parameter as well. So models, as we say, are always a simplification of the real world. Stress tests, which I think off the top of my head is only yourselves and Funding Circle that's bring to mind. We'll come on to those in a minute. And maybe you can share some of your numbers. But stress tests have tended, of course, to focus on credit issues. There are quite a lot of other risks that lenders are also exposed to and worry about, some of which can't necessarily be modelled so well, like, I don't know, cyber fraud, or, well, maybe fraud can be because of credit cards, hacking or something, so hackers take the whole thing down or something like that. How do you think of these less modelable risks?
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to, say, measure or define, you know, what is your risk of a cyber attack? And like another stress test, A, what is the risk of it happening? And B, what are the consequences if it does happen? And in terms of cyber attack, the thing that people have to remember is within peer-to-peer lending, we don't have direct access to bank accounts, etc. The people's money is sitting in segregated client accounts that is covered by financial services compensation scheme that is sitting with Barclays or RBS or whoever it might be. And so it's more of a data issue if we're hacked. And, you know, we do, like anyone else, I'm sure, a hell of a lot in terms of IT security, or as much as we can. However, when you look at the big global companies that get hacked and the amount of money they spend on IT security, then anyone that stands up and says we're unhackable, A, is telling a lie, and B, all they're doing is challenging the hackers to have a go. So everyone is exposed, everyone is open to that risk.
You're leading with your glass chin. And I think the point there, which is a very good point, which is sticking to the stress test mentality here, is that you can get stress tests where you can numerically model them quantitatively, but there are also qualitative stress tests. And this qualitative stress test with hackers, the important point that you're making is that you ain't got all the cash sitting in the corner of your office. It is in whoever it is, Citigroup's.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, behind all their firewalls and all their kind of stuff there. So moving on then to some answers, I'm wondering what the answers tell us. Does it tell us anything? Can we predict the next crisis? Or as you're saying, you know, we just take a reasonable set of assumptions about, oh, this is pretty bad weather. It's not the worst weather I can imagine. It's pretty bad weather. And actually some other people we've hired also say it's pretty bad weather. And
I suppose to begin with, there were two reasons why we did it, which kind of links into, therefore, in some of the results, is one, I think, was obviously to help inform our lenders to sort of understand the risks that they're taking. We have a view here at Lambay in terms of peer-to-peer. People should understand the risks they're taking and get compensated for that risk. Yeah. And so therefore, you know, they're the ones whose capital's online and they should get compensated for it. And therefore explaining risk in some way is very, very important. And that's why, for example, we also publish our loan book. Second of all, as you mentioned earlier on, we also have a provisioning fund. And so it's quite important for us to turn around and think, actually, you know, how much are we provisioning? This kind of helps us think about that. And it's very well saying, oh, we provision, we've got a fund sitting of £500,000. But what does that mean?
Exactly.
And so, again, and while we can't guarantee it's perfect, we can say, well, actually, we've provisioned on a stressed environment, and then we'll add an increment to that. And so they were the two main reasons why we did it. Secondly, goes back to what you were saying earlier. The other thing that we realise actually is going through that process and looking at, you know, what happens when someone's default and how that leads through to a loss in the model, i.e. do we become receiver of rent? If someone stops paying the mortgage, we have the legal right to take over and the rent comes straight in and we can service the mortgage and just sit on the asset until a time.
So actually you're kind of belt and tube races, aren't you?
Exactly. So we have the rights to it. And obviously we can sell, but we can look at data in terms of how quickly it takes to sell a property, what the average cost of a sale is, the loss given a sale. Yeah. And so actually it's helped us actually refine our collections policy, where you can see actually this might be a better way of doing it. But also with an underwriting and credit policy, you can see certain increments in things and certain drivers that actually a small movement here can have quite a big impact, whereas actually a big movement in another area actually makes less impact than you think.
Yes, coming back to this stress test surface, depending on the parameter, so you turn it around and this parameter is very jaggedy, then you know you need operationally to be very careful that. And coming back to the parameter point, I mean, it's a very important one that you mentioned there, which is that, again, you know, banks tend to do fairly simplistic stress tests, I feel, and one of them might say, oh, let's assume property prices fall 20%. But what does it actually mean? So, as anybody with house will know, if you have to sell your house tomorrow, you're going to get one price. If you've got 3 months or 6 months to sell it, you're going to get another price.
Yeah.
How have you approached that one? Have you put in some period of time?
Again, we actually used historic industry data in terms of averages in this scenario. What you actually find is that the sort of average default to possession timeline can be up to about 3 years. And then actually the possession to sale is typically anywhere between 0 and 12 months. So you're looking at potentially up to a sort of, not up to, I mean, that's a median, so obviously it can be greater. We've used industry averages for that. And then what we've also done is looked at the loss from a forced sale effectively. And that's not the cost of, you know, the legal costs and estate agency costs or whatever it might be. That is, if a house price actually today is worth 100,000 and you have to sell it quickly, what do you get for it, typically?
Fire sale.
It's a fire sale. And so it's not linked to the value of property. So that's a different risk of, obviously, house price fall, but based on what that property is technically valued. And what you find, actually, is that that number can be anywhere between 25 and 50%. It's a lot higher than people anticipate. And what you find is actually abnormal properties. When I say abnormal, I mean either things that are quite small or low in value, and things that are very big in value have a bigger discount than something that is fairly homogenous, you know, two up, two down, terraced.
Less liquid market, in a way.
And so that loss given sale assumptions and data for us was one of the, I'd like to say highlights, but lowlights in some way, is that what you do realize that actually, unless you're only lending a 50% loan to value, when you have a forced repossession and a sell, chances are you're going to lose some money on a particular loan. And so that's where it comes into that braces bit, having that ability to actually say, well, actually, we can service the loan from a rent and it's rented out. And actually, we can therefore, we can take our time to sell. We're not in a forced sale scenario because it is serving itself.
Absolutely. And what LTVs do you go up to?
We do lend up to 80%. We do very little over 75%. And 75, most lenders go between, in buy-to-let, between 75 and 85.
Yeah.
There's a few that do 85. Our average on the book is about 63, 64%. So we don't like lending over 75. When we do, we always ask for a lot more what we call rental coverage. And again, that is key because it goes back to that point in terms of servicing the loan.
Which is that, for example, the rental income is twice the mortgage or 100 times the mortgage or 1.1 times the mortgage payment.
And what it means, therefore, even if you're entering a situation of higher unemployment and a drop in rental demand, you've got that buffer there. So you can just cut the rent by 20% to make sure it's rented out and therefore service the mortgage. And, you know, what we found is the scenario that we looked at was the Bank of England, both the base scenario and then the stress scenario. And as I said, the stress scenario looks something like unemployment goes to 8.5%, GDP falls 3.5%, house prices fall 20%. The next question people ask is, well, actually, what happens worse than that? Yeah. And actually, when we looked and looked at the difference between house prices falling 20 to 25, it actually virtually made no difference. Unemployment, and actually that demand for rental property and whether people are going to get into rental is the big driver of losses, as opposed to actually the security bit, which is perhaps counterfactual.
It's very interesting. I mean, I may have got to that if I actually thought about it, but it just shows that there's quite a difference between just being a mortgage P2P and doing the buy-to-let.
Yeah.
It's very different characteristics of the asset. So, having said that, I don't really believe in single numbers and this kind of stuff. What's your single number then?
0.03.
No. 0.23.
So in a stressed environment, so the Bank of England stressed environment, we would be on an average portfolio, as it goes back to saying, GDP falling 3.5% over an 18-month period. So it's broken down that way. And unemployment roughly doubling from where it is today and house prices falling 20%. What we'd be looking at is round about 0.5 to 0.6 losses.
Percent, which is nothing.
Which is a relatively low amount.
Which is nothing, given that investors, if they stick cash in your thing, get whatever, 3, 4, 5% at the moment, don't they?
Exactly. And if you took the house price bit by itself, which again is a little bit false because there's obviously correlation between unemployment and house prices, but if you just stress the house prices a bit more, that would only go up by about 5 or 6 basis points.
Yeah.
Whereas if you push the unemployment a lot more, that could potentially then go above 1%.
So you were really into the detail, and you've put a lot of work into this, obviously. But again, from a super big picture, if these numbers are quotes to be believed, and you've had them done externally, and you've explained all the assumptions behind them, so it seems a very valid exercise. Even if you double them or triple them, it's not really something that investors are going to worry about. You know, you'd have to go well beyond those parameters for them to start having a negative return.
Absolutely.
From what you understand.
The lowest return on our platform is, in terms of gross return, is 3.5%. And so you would need quite a super stressed scenario to actually get to a point where you're having negative returns.
Well, I think what the grown-up answer is, and I really like it where you're coming from, is that investment as a whole is about taking risk. So you're offering a return, and you're doing your best to minimise the risks, and then you're trying to explain what the residual risks are, and what your understanding is in normal circumstances, in really difficult circumstances. And of course, we can all imagine some, you know, nuclear war breaks out or something like that when everything goes out the window. My feeling I get just from hearing you talk about these things is that, in a sense, it shows how expensive it is funneling liquidity through a bank. The cost of a bank is so great to take the lender's money and give it to a borrower that they erode, as well as being leveraged, all the safety margin. Conversely, for a well-run P2P, the costs of taking in digitally borrower money and giving it to lender is relatively low. So you have got a huge safety margin. I think that's where the huge safety margin is coming from.
Yes, absolutely. And we can run on, as you say, much lower margins, and therefore the lender or investor gets the vast majority of the interest rate. And the other thing I'd say, it always makes me laugh when you see various reports from banks who like now to issue reports on peer-to-peer lending and say it's risky, you might lose money. And that's absolutely correct. You may lose money. I mean, you know, our stress scenario, it might be worse than that. You might lose money. But actually, the one thing you're guaranteed right now if putting money in your bank is you are losing money in terms of real inflation-adjusted returns.
Exactly.
So with a bank, it's guaranteed.
Exactly, or vice versa. The one thing you're guaranteed is that you put money into a platform today, you're making more money today, more money tomorrow, more money tomorrow, more money tomorrow. And that accumulated profit history starts to pay for something after a while. So the question arises, and this is one for the regulator, but people will know my cynical view of regulators being quite good at closing doors that the horses have already run out of, which is that I would have thought in an ideal world, the regulators should say, yes, everybody should stress test them and everyone should do it externally, especially, in my opinion, the provision funds. I think provision funds that aren't stress tested are a huge anomaly across finance. If you're an insurance company, you've got basically a huge provision fund. If you're a bank, you've got a huge provision fund. And you absolutely have to have external people verifying that and all kinds of auditor stuff. But in this new market where the schoolboy is in his fifth year or doing his GCSEs, he hasn't quite yet got to that stage. I mean, presumably, you having done it, you think external stress testing is a good thing?
Absolutely. And again, as it goes on, I think we've got benefits, internal benefits that we didn't expect to get. Just going through the process, regardless of the number at the end, it's helped us. You know, we'll do it every year and we'll do it to the Bank of England scenario. The problem, obviously, if everyone was to do it, in some ways, everyone's got to do it to the same economic scenario, because if people are picking scenarios, for that reason, we took the Bank of England one. And again, you could look at the Bank of England one and think, oh, actually, I'm not sure that's likely to happen, but that's kind of not the point. And then you get to that situation is, can you game it? And are there some stress testers that are a little bit more lax than other stress testers? So it's a bit like the credit rating issue.
Exactly, which is that I set up my stress testing company and I do it so thoroughly that everybody's going to go bust when they stick their numbers to me. Not many people are going to come and use me. Yeah. So anyway, that's the challenge of the industry as a whole, but it's not yet mandatory, unfortunately. So, John, moving on to LandBay, as you say, you're in a huge marketplace. I think you've got a fantastic model in terms of you've got the mortgage, you've got the security of the rental income, and you've also got a provision fund behind that. This is a model that could go really well. You've created and run a business before and expanded it, so touch wood, it all looks fantastic. And it's not just my impression of that. As I recall from reading a little while ago, £250 million came your way one way or another. What was that about?
Yeah, so there was a separate, not a LandBay mortgage product that was in the market that had been run by a large, we call mortgage packager or mortgage broker, that was funded by one of the challenger banks, Aldermore. And that was potentially coming up for renewal and potentially looking for new funding. And we were aware of an institution that was looking to deploy money in this area and wanted to securitize mortgages. And so therefore, it probably wasn't right that they took straight LandBay mortgages. And so therefore, what we did is we've sort of taken over the funding of that mortgage product that, say, has been in existence for 3 years. It's over the 3 year period, it's had one late payment, which was 4 days. So it's a very strong performing book, lots of data. It's all buy to let. And it's been funded by, you know, an institution. And again, that will build up over time. We're actually the first mortgage on it completed. We took over July the 1st. The first mortgage completed in August. There'll be a number that complete this month, September. So it'll do 2 to 3 million this month and it will build up to a point where it's probably lending 15 to 20 million a month.
So I think the takeaway for me from that is that, you know, you are very serious players when you're replacing, you know, a very serious challenger bank like Aldermore that's now floated on the marketplace. Am I also right in understanding that what you're talking about in this sense, very loosely in an organogram, that's almost like a parallel division? It's not affecting your mainstream business. It's not like you're turning away institutions and retail investors now because you still like their money, because then the mainstream business carries on regardless.
Absolutely. At the moment, LandBay is retail funded, wholly retail funded, those LandBay mortgages. And that separate, what's called the Keystone mortgages, which are funded by LandBay, is almost a silo. Obviously, we'll talk to anyone. Our view is, you know, we'll take institution money, we'll take retail money, but we'll always prioritise retail money. We're not going to turn retail money away. It's why P2P was born, really, I think.
And so what key things are you looking for in the future? What's exciting about LandBay?
We've got to just grow what we're doing. We've got a number of product innovations, which I'm afraid we can't talk about now, that we think will come to market end of this year and beginning of next year that will potentially both change peer-to-peer lending. I think there's some innovation on that side, but actually on the other side, And this would be, I think, a first globally if we manage to do it, but also on the other side, actually a type of buy-to-let mortgage product that doesn't exist in terms of how we're creating it. And those two together actually are potentially quite interesting. So there's lots of product innovation, none of it on the credit side. So we're never going to move down the credit quality curve, because often innovation in financial services normally means take more risk.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's not what we're looking to do. So, you know, there's lots of exciting things there. But, you know, the credit for us is key. And, you know, we've taken the head of underwriting from Paragon, which is one of the biggest lenders in buy-to-let and one of the best performing, to come in as our head of lending. I always believe that fintech and certainly peer-to-peer lending should be more focused on the fin than the tech in some ways.
Absolutely, absolutely. And too much focus on the tech, as you said before, is dangerous. And certainly my perception of you guys at LandBay is that you're doing things very solidly and also in a very open and transparent way, in terms of, I think you're one of the first, if not the first, to publish the borrower rates, which not everybody does, even the ones who say they're transparent. You're now doing an external stress test. You know, you're first sort of very small handful to have done that. And you've got lots of interesting developments in the pipeline. So I think LandBay is a company that listeners would be worth knowing about, and investors would certainly be worth checking out, because there is quite a lot of security behind it. And in terms of the stress testing, I think it's very interesting actually hearing about somebody who's been through the exercise. I think the sort of things for me is that the market specific data is really important. I mean, it's all very well saying GDP 2%, but, you know, what does it mean for the marketplace? The external point we've discussed, having a specialist that really knows the market is really important. Having an area with rich data, again, makes the exercise much more important. And I think that, coming back to this whole idea of stress tests as being a surface with various parameters, it's almost like the single number is missing the point, whether it's 0.5 or 1.5, that's just a number. And as you say, it's very interesting to hear you having got insights from actually conducting this exercise in terms of, you know, where to tighten the nuts most and the focus in the organisation in terms of your process. So I wish you every success with your annual stress test in the future. And I hope the numbers remain small and the yields remain large. And I hope LandBay continues to grow well. And so next time there's going to be a market crash and you're selling LandBay, I'll sell all my assets, because a year later we'll have another 2008. So thanks for that, John.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Very enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, watch the firelight dance with me, watch the firelight dance with me, watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.